charming card in the shop window.
Oh, the rooms, yes, yes. Won't you come in, please?
Thank you.
And so begins The Lady Killers, the classic dark British comedy that has travelled from Ealing to Hollywood and back to the West End. And this Sunday afternoon, you can enjoy the radio adaptation right here on 4Extra. Doors open at 1:30.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Crime and Thrillers Hour, and next, let's get back to the business of murder. It's time Poirot teamed up with the constabulary to get to the bottom of this nasty business at Smuggler's Island.
I had gone down to the Jolly Roger Hotel on Smuggler's Island in search of good food, peace and quiet, and gentle English sunshine. And I had found violent death. Arlena Marshall, a femme fatale if ever there was one, had been brutally strangled on a deserted beach. There were two people who had very good reason to wish Arlena Marshall dead. Christine Redfern, whose husband Patrick had been pursuing a passionate love affair with her, and Captain Marshall, Arlena's husband, who had seemed to turn a blind eye to what was going on. But were there other, less obvious motives for the murder? That was what, only a few hours after the body had been discovered, my old friend Colonel Weston, assisted by Inspector Colgate and, of course, myself, had to investigate.
We present John Moffat as Hercule Poirot and George Baker as Colonel Weston in Agatha Christie's Evil Under the Sun.
We've got to get it down in black and white where everyone was at the time of the murder. Tedious, time-consuming business. It's got to be done.
Unfortunately, 9 of the guests went off on an excursion first thing this morning and won't be back till 6. And the Coens and the Mastermans, they come here every year with their children, all went off to the mainland for a picnic. I think that leaves them out of it too. Mr. Blatt has gone off sailing and isn't back yet. And the Reverend Lane is off on one of his long country walks.
That narrows the field a little. Perhaps we ought to get Marshall's daughter in. Not fair to keep the girl hanging around.
I'll go and find her, Colonel.
Thank you. She's a child of Marshall's first marriage, I take it.
Her mother was Sophia Martindale.
An arsenic poisoner.
She was acquitted.
Even so. What a background for the poor child. How old is she?
16. And rather young for her age.
I didn't see Arlena at all this morning. She has breakfast in bed and always gets down late. I can't bear to lie in, not when I'm on holiday.
Will you tell us what you did this morning?
I went to have a swim first thing. Then I met Mrs. Redfern and she asked me to go with her to Gull Cove.
What time did you and Mrs. Redfern set out?
She said she'd be waiting for me in the lounge at 10:30. I thought I was going to be late, but I wasn't. We left just before 10:30.
And what did you do when you got to Gull Cove?
I lay in the sun for a while, and Mrs. Redfern did some sketching in the shade. She doesn't like sunbathing. Then, later, she went back to the hotel to get changed for her tennis match, and I went for a swim.
Do you remember what time that was?
When Mrs. Redfern went back to the hotel?
Mm-hmm.
11:45.
You are sure of that?
Oh, yes. I looked at my watch.
The watch you have on now?
Yes.
Mind if I see? Correct to a second.
And after that, you had a bathe?
Yes.
And when did you get back to the hotel?
About 1:00. And then I heard about Arlena.
Did you get on all right with your stepmother?
Oh, yes.
Did you like her, mademoiselle?
Oh, yes, I was very fond of her. She was very kind to me.
Not the wicked stepmother, eh?
Oh, no, not at all.
You did not feel resentful when your father married again. You were not jealous in any way.
Not in the least.
Now, I want you to think very carefully. Have you any idea who might have killed your stepmother? Is there anything you've heard or anything you know that could help us in that respect?
No. I don't know who would have wanted to kill Arlena. Except, of course, Mrs. Redfern.
And why do you think that Mrs. Redfern would want to kill her?
because her husband was in love with Arlena. But I don't think she'd actually want to do it herself. She'd just wished that she was dead. And that isn't the same thing at all, is it?
No, it is not at all the same.
And anyway, Mrs. Redfern could never do a thing like that. She isn't a violent person, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. She's not one of those who sees red. She would not be shaken by a storm of feeling, seeing life narrowing in front of her, seeing a hated face, a hated white neck, feeling her hands clench, longing to feel them press into the flesh.
Can I go now? Is that all?
Yes, that's all, Linda. Thank you for helping us. You know, I felt a bit of a cad questioning her about what went on between her father and stepmother. All the same, it had to be done. Murder is murder. She's the person most likely to know the truth of things about them. I'm rather thankful she had nothing to tell us on that score.
Yes, I thought you were.
Don't you think you went a bit too far with all that hands sinking into the flesh business? Not quite the sort of idea to put into a child's head.
So, you thought I was putting ideas into her head?
Well, weren't you? Anyway, all we really got out of her was an alibi for the Redfern woman. Exit the jealous wife as top suspect.
There are better reasons than that for leaving Mrs. Redfern out of it. Apart from anything else, her hands are too small and delicate.
I suppose the Redferns ought to be our next priority. Which of them should we start with?
With the husband, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Before he has had too much time to recover from the shock.
I met her at a cocktail party about 3 months ago.
Captain Marshall has implied that until you both met down here, you did not know each other well. Is that so, Mr. Redfern?
Well, not exactly. As a matter of fact, I saw a fair amount of her one way or another.
Without Captain Marshall's knowledge?
I don't know whether he knew about it or not.
And was it also without your wife's knowledge, Mr. Redfern?
I believe that I mentioned to my wife I had met the famous Arlena Stewart.
But she did not know how frequently you were seeing her.
Probably not.
Did you and Mrs. Marshall arrange to meet down here?
I don't think there's much point in my trying to conceal anything from you. Arlena wanted me to come down here. I didn't really think it was a good idea with my wife and Marshall being here. But I suspect it was an added excitement as far as she was concerned. In the end, well, I would have agreed to do any mortal thing she asked me to. She had that kind of effect on people.
The eternal Circe.
She certainly could turn men into swine. I was completely infatuated with her. Whether she cared for me or not, I simply don't know. She pretended to, but I think she was one of those women who lose interest in a man once they've got him body and soul. She knew she'd got me all right. When I saw her lying there, dead on the beach this morning, it was like being hit by a bolt of lightning.
And now?
How much of this has got to be made public? It's not as though it could have any bearing on her death, and if it all comes out, it's going to be pretty rough on my wife.
And that concerns you, does it?
I realize you must think I haven't given her much thought up to now, but the real truth is that I care for my wife very deeply. Arlena was a kind of madness, the sort of damn fool thing that men do. But Christine is different. She's real. Badly though I've treated her, I've known all along that she was the person who really counted. I wish I could make you believe that.
But I do believe it, Monsieur Redfern. Oh, yes. I believe it.
Thank you, Monsieur Poirot.
If your infatuation for Mrs. Marshall played no part in the murder, then there will be no point in dragging it into the open. But what you don't seem to realize is that your intimacy with Mrs. Marshall may have a very direct bearing on the murder. It might establish a motive for the crime.
I don't follow you.
Supposing that Captain Marshall had found out about your affair with his wife.
You mean he might have killed her?
It had not occurred to you?
Never. Marshall's such a quiet kind of chap. It doesn't seem likely.
What was the attitude of Arlena Marshall toward this? Was she frightened that her husband might find out, or did she not care?
There were times when she seemed a bit nervous about it all.
Did she seem afraid of him?
No, I wouldn't say that.
And was there at
any time a question of divorce.
Oh, no. I would never have done that to Christine, and I'm sure Arlena never thought of such a thing. She was perfectly satisfied with the husband she'd got. I was just one of a succession of poor mutts. Just something to pass the time with. I knew that all along, but it didn't alter my feelings towards her.
Now, Mr. Redfern, did you have a particular appointment with Mrs. Marshall this morning?
No, not a particular appointment exactly. We usually met every morning on the beach. We'd swim or paddle about on floats.
Were you surprised not to find her there?
Yes, I was. I couldn't understand it at all.
If she were keeping an appointment somewhere else, do you have any idea with whom that might be?
No idea.
And when you had a rendezvous with Mrs. Marshall, where did you go?
Well, sometimes in the afternoon we'd meet at Gull Cove. The sun is off there at that time, so you don't usually get many people there.
Did you ever meet at the other place, Pixie Cove?
No, you see, Pixie Cove faces west, and people go around there in boats or on floats in the afternoon.
And your private rendezvous, they were always in the afternoon?
Yes. That's the time when most people go and have a sleep or mooch about, and nobody knows much where anyone is. After dinner, of course, we used to go off on a stroll together.
Ah, yes.
Then you can give us no help whatsoever as to why Mrs. Marshall should have gone off to Pixie Cove this morning.
I haven't the faintest idea. It wasn't like Arlena at all.
Can you think of anyone in her London circle who might have had a grudge against her? Someone you may have supplanted in her affection, perhaps?
I honestly can't think of anyone.
So, we seem to be left with three possibilities. An unknown killer, some maniac who just happened to be in the vicinity. And that's a pretty tall order.
But isn't it the most likely explanation?
Pixie Cove is practically inaccessible. You can only get at it by boat or by walking over the causeway, crossing the island by the hotel and climbing down a rickety ladder. Neither way suggests a killing on the spur of the moment.
You said there were three possibilities.
There were two people on the island who had a very good reason for killing her. Her husband for one, and your wife for another.
My wife? Oh, but that's ridiculous. She's not that kind of person. There's no violence in her. Anyway, Arlena was much stronger than Christine. I doubt whether she could strangle a kitten, let alone a woman like Arlena. Oh, Christine could never have got down that ladder. She's no head for heights at all, no. No, no. She couldn't have done it.
Didn't think it necessary to tell the fellow his wife had got an alibi. Shook him up a bit, didn't it?
The arguments he advanced were as strong as any alibi.
Oh, she couldn't have done it. Marshall could, but he too has an alibi.
Well, the fact that he was typing letters? Oh, not very reliable.
And the letters themselves?
He could perfectly well have prepared them beforehand. The man is not a fool.
Well, I'll get Colgate to look into it.
Patrick said you wanted to have a word with me.
Oh, yes, Mrs. Redfern. Come in. Sit down, please.
Thank you.
You know Monsieur Poirot, of course. We're asking everyone to account for their movements this morning. Pure routine, you understand.
Where do you want me to begin?
As early as possible, madame. What did you do when you got up this morning?
On my way to breakfast, I went into Linda Marshall's room. She wasn't there, but I met her in the corridor. I asked her if she'd like to come with me to Gull Cove.
At what time was this?
About 8:30.
And where had Miss Marshall been?
She said she had been swimming.
And what time did you set out for Gull Cove?
I think it was just on 10:30.
And what did you do at Gull Cove?
I did a few sketches and Linda sunbathed.
And what time did you leave the cove?
At 11:45. I had a tennis match and had to change.
You had your watch with you?
No, I had to ask Linda what the time was.
I see.
And then I packed up my sketching things and went back to the hotel.
And Mademoiselle Linda?
Linda went and had a swim.
Now, did Linda Marshall actually enter the water before you left the beach?
Yes. She ran down to the sea as I was fastening my box. She was splashing about in the waves as I was on the path up the cliff.
You are quite sure of that, madame? That she really entered the sea?
Oh, yes.
Go on, Mrs. Redfern.
I went back to the hotel, changed and went to the tennis court, where I met the others. We played for about an hour and were just going back into the hotel when we heard about Mrs. Marshall.
And what did you think, madame, when you heard the news?
What did I think?
Yes.
It was a horrible thing to happen.
Ah, yes. Your fastidiousness was revolted, I understand that. But what did it mean to you personally? Were you really surprised by the manner of her death?
I think I see what you mean. No, I was not surprised. Shocked, yes. But she was the kind of woman...
She was the kind of woman to whom such a thing might happen. Yes, madame. That is the truest and most significant thing that has been said in this room. Now, leaving all personal feeling aside, what did you really think of Mrs. Marshall?
Is it really worthwhile going into all this now?
I think it might be, yes.
She's the kind of woman that's absolutely worthless as far as I'm concerned. She had no mind. She thought of nothing but men and clothes. She was a useless parasite. She was the sort of woman who could be mixed up in everything sordid. Blackmail, jealousy, violence, every kind of crude emotion. She appealed to the worst in people.
Mrs. Redfern, why did you mention blackmail?
Because she was being blackmailed.
And how can you be certain of that?
I happened to overhear something. You remember, Monsieur Poirot, that night we were playing bridge. My husband and I, you and Miss Darnley. I was dummy. It was very stuffy in the card room, and I went down to the beach for a breath of fresh air. Suddenly I heard voices. Mrs. Marshall was saying something like, "It's no good. I can't get any more money now. My husband will suspect something." And a man's voice said, "I'm not taking any excuses, Mrs. Marshall."
Do you know who the man was?
He was keeping his voice very low. It could have been anybody.
Now we're getting somewhere.
But I am not certain where. It is not a wicked blackmailer who lies dead. It is the victim. And blackmailers are not in the habit of killing off their victims.
Well, I can't deny that. But it does suggest a reason for Mrs. Marshall's going off to Pixie Cove by herself. She was meeting the fellow who was blackmailing her.
Pixie Cove would certainly be the ideal place for such a rendezvous. It is difficult of access, and it is deserted in the morning. And it has another advantage. I heard about it the other day. There is a cave there, a place where someone could wait, unseen.
Well, we'd better take a look inside it. We might find a pointer of some kind. You know, Poirot, this blackmail business does rather put a different complexion on things. None of the men staying here fitted the bill as a possible lover for Arlena Marshall. But a blackmailer's a very different kettle of fish. I'd like to have a word with Mr. Black when he comes back from his morning sailing.
Yes. A boat. That is very suggestive.
We'd better get back inside. It's time to ask Miss Brewster if she knows anything.
And after you and Mr. Redfern had found Mrs. Marshall's body, you rode back alone rather than taking the quicker route overland, huh?
No power on earth would make me climb the ladder up that cliff. I can face many things, but I have no head for heights.
And there's nothing else you know of that could help us in any way?
Well, there was one funny thing that happened earlier.
What was that, Miss Brewster?
Somebody nearly brained me with a bottle. While I was having my morning bathe before breakfast, chucked it out of one of the hotel windows.
Very distressing for you, but I don't think it tells us much.
Sorry I couldn't be more help, but I don't imagine you'll have much trouble finding out who did it.
What makes you think that?
Well, with a woman like that, I mean, you've only got to hunt around in her unsavoury past.
Someone who had a grudge against her and came over from the mainland without anyone seeing him?
Oh, why should anyone see him? Mrs. Redfern and the Marshall child were over at Gull Cove. The rest of us were on the beach. Who on earth was there to see him except Miss Darnley?
And where was Miss Darnley?
Well, she was sitting in the cutting at the top of the cliff, sunny ledge. Mr. Redfern and I saw her when we were rowing round the island.
I see. Well, we'd better find out if she noticed anyone.
Not a soul, Colonel. And I would certainly have noticed if anyone had come along the path.
What about by sea? Did you notice anyone on a float or a boat during the morning?
No, I didn't. I was reading, you see. Of course, I looked out from my book from time to time, but as it happened, the sea was quite deserted every time I did so.
You didn't even notice Mr. Redfern and Miss Brewster when they went round?
No.
You were, I think, acquainted with Captain Marshall.
Ken was an old family friend. We grew up together. I hadn't seen him for a good many years.
And Mrs. Marshall?
I'd never exchanged half a dozen words with her before I met her here.
Would you say that Captain Marshall was devoted to his wife?
He may have been. I can't really tell you. He's rather old-fashioned. He doesn't have the modern habit of shouting his matrimonial woes from the rooftops.
Did you like Mrs. Marshall?
No.
Why was that?
Surely by now you've discovered that Arlena Marshall wasn't exactly popular with her own sex. She was bored to death when she was with women, and she showed it. Though I must say, I admired her style. She had a great gift for clothes, and she wore them well.
She spent a great deal on clothes.
She must have done. But then she had money of her own, and Captain Marshall is quite well off.
Did you ever hear that she was being blackmailed?
Blackmailed? Arlena?
The idea seems to surprise you.
But what would anyone blackmail Arlena about?
There are certain things, I suppose, that Mrs. Marshall might not want to come to her husband's ears.
Well, I suppose so, but Arlena was rather notorious in the way she carried on. She never made any pretense of respectability.
You think, then, that her husband was aware of her various affairs?
You know, I really don't know what to think. I've always assumed that Kenneth accepted his wife for what she was, that he had no illusions about her. But it may not be so. Men can be very stupid sometimes.
What exactly do you mean by that?
Kenneth Marshall is really rather unworldly, you know. At heart, he's a bit of an idealist with rather old-fashioned notions about women. He may have believed in Arlena quite blindly. He may have thought she was just admired.
And you know no one who was likely to have had a grudge against Mrs. Marshall?
No, I can't think of anyone. But then I probably wouldn't know.
I thought you might have had some contact with her through your dressmaking business.
I only wish I had. Yeah. But Arlena never came to me for dresses. A pity. I should have made a small fortune. No, Colonel, if you want to find out the dirt about Arlena, you need to talk to someone in her own intimate circle.
Thank you, Miss Darnley.
Well, hasn't Monsieur Poirot any questions to ask?
I can think of nothing, mademoiselle. Thank you.
Thank you, Monsieur Poirot.
Of course, we've only got her word for it that she spent all the time reading on Sunny Ledge.
You are right. The fact that Mr. Redfern and Miss Brewster noticed her there does not account for the whole time. But would she have been capable of strangling Arlena?
She certainly had a motive of sorts. She was a childhood friend of Marshall.
Mm.
She may have resented him marrying a woman she disapproved of.
And she may have resented even more the way in which Arlena Marshall treated her husband, taking a succession of young lovers and never even trying to conceal the fact from him. Oh, yes, it is easy enough to see that Rosamond Darnley may have hated her. But did she really hate her so much as to wish to kill her?
Well, I don't see why not. She may have thought the risk was well worth taking. With Arlena out of the way, there was nothing to stand in the way of her and Marshall.
And she is an exceedingly attractive woman.
Come in.
I thought you ought to know that some of the guests are getting a bit restive. We've been keeping them out of their rooms on the upstairs corridor. If you want to have a look around, the sooner the better.
Oh, thank you for reminding me, Inspector. We'll come right away. We'd better start with the Marshall's rooms.
Arlena Marshall certainly had a most extensive wardrobe. Dresses, lingerie, beach hats. Enough to last her for an entire year. Les femmes.
There's a packet of letters here. 3 from young Redfern. He'll learn not to write letters to women after this. Women always keep letters and swear blind they've burnt them. Here's one from some other chap.
Mm-hmm. Dearest Alena, God, I feel blue. To be going out to China and perhaps not seeing you again for years. I didn't know that any man could go on feeling crazy for a woman the way I feel for you. Thanks for the check. They won't prosecute now. It was a close shave, though, and all because I wanted to make money for you, to buy you the most fabulous emerald in the world. Don't forget me. I know you won't. You are mine always. J.N.
Another poor mutt.
It might be worthwhile to find out if this J.N., whoever he was, really did go to China. Otherwise, he might be just the person we're looking for. Thinks he's found the love of his life and suddenly discovers he's been played for a sucker.
It's certainly worth following up.
Yes. That letter is important. I find it very important.
Shall we take a look at Marshall's room?
I'd like to have a look through his letters. See if there's anything to bear out his story about having to type those financial statements in a hurry.
And while you are doing that, I shall inspect Mademoiselle Linda's room.
Good idea. There's always a chance that Marshall may have put something in his daughter's room that he didn't want us to find.
All very neat and tidy for the room of a teenager. Everything in its proper place. Huh. It looks as if she has been burning something in the fireplace. A lump of something that looks like candle grease and some fragments of green paper with a figure 5. Part of a pull-off calendar, perhaps. And a pin. And some burnt hair. What is one to make of all this? Oh, pour l'amour de Dieu, is it possible? And the books on the shelf. The Marriage of William Ashe? Very dull reading for a 16-year-old. But perhaps the best the lending library had to offer. Murder in the Cathedral, The Burning Court, something wedged behind them. A History of Witchcraft and Sorcery. So, I was right. But as to the other, is that also possible? No, it is not possible. Unless...
In part 3 of Agatha Christie's Evil Under the Sun, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat and Colonel Weston by George Baker. Christine Redfern, Susanna Corbett, Patrick Redfern, Ian Glenn, Rosamund Darnley, Sabina Franklin. Miss Brewster, Joan Littlewood, Linda Marshall, Lindsay Fawcett, Inspector Colgate, Gerard McDermott. Evil Under the Sun is dramatized for radio by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams.
Yes? Yes, unless what? What a place to end. Well, tomorrow, despite that particularly jaunty music, Poirot takes his thinking about the witchcraft theme a little bit further in part 4 of Evil Under the Sun at the same time. Now, there is 1930s period comedy on 4Extra in E.F. Benson's Secret Lives. Behind the twitching curtains, the residents of Durham Square are keen to maintain their lofty standards. But is the arrival of a new tenant about to bring down the whole neighbourhood?
My word, what a fortune she must have spent. Leather on the walls, not even Morocco, Spanish. And that chandelier, dear me. Ostentatious, I think, is the word I should... That smell. What is that smell? Incense? Oh, no, surely not. And the square so blessedly free from any moral taint.
Pauline Collins and Margot Boyd star in Secret Lives, continuing tomorrow morning at 10.
Fisher, German Bite.
Marking 90 years of radio in 90 seconds. 1929.
Val Gielgud did not, of course, create the drama department. It had been going for 5 years. How was this new young director of productions received when he took up his appointment in the new year of 1929?
Val must have been exactly Reith's idea of what an artistic person should be. You know, the cloak, the beard, the exotic sort of name, the sword stick.
People felt Val knew about the theatre, which he did. It's perfectly true. I mean, he was related to the Terrys.
We used to do a first reading of a play, and Val very wisely kept his trap tightly shut.
He would fly into a sudden small rage and crash his fist with signet ring down on the table.
Is an absolutely East European, almost Dostoevskian kind of Polish heart.
He was a very elegant, sophisticated person and smoked Turkish cigarettes.
Written against in the Radio Times, Val's loyalty was always there.
He never put on any of the new drama.
At one time, a controller was put in to coordinate the various networks. He simply said in the departmental meeting, nobody talks to this man.
He fought for his chaps when he thought they were right, and he ticked them off when he thought they were wrong.
Oh, it's so unusual that he drives me wild.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
You're with 4 Extra, it's Wes Butters at 9 o'clock. And now this evening's I Was There Too story. A 97-year-old American academic relates her memories of the night of the Roswell incident in New Mexico, 1947, when the US government allegedly covered up an encounter with aliens. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio reads Nothing But Blue Skies by Dominic Power.
Back then, we worried about stuff falling from the sky. Atom bombs, mostly. It was more than 2 years since President Harry Truman dropped the big one on Japan and the country lost its innocence. You were asking me about Roswell. I remember at the time there were some people who thought it was some kind of nuclear test that had gone wrong. In those days, people didn't get so mad about that kind of thing. They figured the government knew best, just like they figured it was okay for Harry Truman to give the order to wipe out Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Linda, I guess you're wondering why I'm making you this recording since I flat refused to tell you anything when you drove here from Albuquerque last March. The thing is, you never told me how you knew I was there when that thing fell from the sky. That intrigued me. And you are a smart girl, so I liked you, in spite of you invading my privacy. I enjoyed the idea for your book, too. The Politics of Mass Hallucination is a good title, and if I'm still alive when it comes out, I'd surely like to read it. When I said last March that I couldn't help you about Roswell, I wasn't telling the truth. I was there, and I did witness some of what happened. But I've never wanted to talk about it. I've seen the movies and read some of the books, and I've watched how the folks who say they saw it have been changed. And I didn't want that to happen to me. But lately I've been feeling differently about things. At my age, I figure I'm not going to be here much longer. I'll be the last of the Rudds in Chavez County, and I want to leave some sort of record. Being the last of the Rudds might not seem like a big thing to you, but there's been Rudds in Chavez County since 1840. My grandfather, Edward D. Rudd, ran for sheriff of Chavez County against Pat Garrett in 1889, which was after Garrett gunned down Billy the Kid. When I was little, Granddaddy used to tell me that Pat Garrett was a scoundrel and everybody knew that the kid didn't have a weapon, so you might say it was as good as murder. I tell my boy Cole about the Rudds that have gone. I don't know if he understands, but he smiles as if he likes the way the words sound. I thought maybe I should make a formal declaration. I'd say, my name is Catherine Rudd. I'm 97 years old. This is my statement about the events that took place in the vicinity of Roswell in Chavez County, New Mexico, on the morning of July 5th in the year of our Lord, 1947. I made a couple of starts like that, but it got me all tangled up. So I'm just going to tell it my way, talking to you by way of this tape recorder. Cole's just brought me a glass of iced tea, same as he does every day about this time, looking out for me like he's always done. But we both know things are changing. And so I guess it's time to put everything in order. Before I decided to send you this recording, I wanted to find out about you. Cole drove me over to the library at Hagerman, and I looked you up on the internet machine they've got there. Linda Rosales, associate professor at the University of New Mexico. In 1947, I was 35 years old, writing a book on Pueblo tribal ceremonies and lecturing in the anthropology department. It looked like I had a good career ahead of me. But then I met Porter Reed, and falling in love with him was the biggest mistake of my life. He was 4 or 5 years younger than me and already making a big noise in the faculty. He'd had a book of poems published, and he surely looked like a poet, always wearing that red check shirt open at the neck. Everyone thought he was an idealist, but the truth is, he had the soul of a politician. All that stuff that came later about him being the laureate of New Mexico and the books and the radio shows and the